Welcoming back to the program, our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His newest book is out and available everywhere. Fine books are sold. It's called If You, brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. I always paused on that one a little bit. You can also get his recent book on Sam Cooke, Sam Cooke Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963, and his terrific book on the 1951 film Scrooge. Hello there, Colin.
What's up, Sir Richard of Bangor?
Doing fine today. Do you have a hot chocolate in hand?
No, I don't, but I was holed up in the Starbucks for many hours before coming back to take your phone call. I had an iced latte today and a water for hydration.
Sounds like they've messed with your Starbucks of choice and redesigned it so it's less inviting to sit there and do work?
Everything in the world, Richard, is getting worse. Community is breaking down, society, culture, and the Starbucks down the street from me at Rose Wharf, right in the harbor there, was formerly this cozy place to sit down and hang out for a long time. So there'd be a lot of people there, and I guess someone could say, like, well, probably just ordered the one drink. And no, it wasn't really that. I would see people there for 5, 6, 7 hours and repeat customers and really homey. And then they shut it down before COVID, and they gutted the place, and they made it almost like an airplane Starbucks. So it's the same space, but it doesn't have any of the communal vibe anymore. And I just feel like everything's going that way. Like we talked recently about personalities and sports, it's like get rid of individualism and everything. So they've had all these problems with business and being closed and strange hours and not being able to have enough staff. And so, I don't know, it's just kind of like me and some school kids there today holding down the Starbucks fort.
One more thing right there. Well, let's talk about a number of subjects this week, beginning with a wonderful live set from 1993, Bob Dylan live at the Supper Club. And yeah, there are those people out there who claim they don't like Dylan singing. I have always enjoyed Dylan singing his own songs more than anybody else doing them because I think he's got an incredibly expressive voice.
I think if someone wants to make the criticism of Dylan's singing, you'd almost have to, you can sort of separate the people who have honest opinions on that and more charlatan-y type takes, because what you'd have to do is single out a phase of Dylan's singing. Mm. Dylan had so many different styles of singing, I would say, and so many tonal centers of singing, really. He's a lot different in 63 as a singer than he is even from 64 as a folk singer, still in those same 2 years, as he's going to be in 65 on like Rolling Stone, songs of that nature. Then he's a lot different on Blonde on Blonde. Then we get to things like 1974, how different he is going around on tour with the band than he was going around on tour with the band in 1966. So this is 1993. And it's the Supper Club in New York City. These recordings are prized by Dylan people. He's done the two Return to Folk albums, kind of, World Gone Wrong and Good As I've Been to You. And he is playing that, a lot of that material, not exclusively that material, because he's working in all of his stuff from his vast body of work. But it seems to me like just something that's ripe for, you know, that official Dylan bootleg series. It's odd to me that this hasn't been tabbed for that yet, because I think this would go like into the top percentage, 1% or whatever it is, of all Dylan releases of any stripe, studio or live.
And certainly one of the highlights of this, and you told me to make sure I checked this out, and it was great, was his live version of Blood in My Eyes.
It's one of those live performances that I feel like one should be grateful that we have it, because it wasn't going to be a Dylan in concert staple. So the original version of the song with a slightly different title was by a band called the Mississippi Sheiks, and that came out in 1932. They also did World Gone Wrong. And the young Dylan, who was someone who went out soaking up everything he could, finding everything he could, all these different aspects of culture, not just musical culture, but was into all the westerns of the 1950s and things like the radio programs we talk about. All of these works will serve you well as a thinker if you do something creative, if whatever it might be, just going about the living of your life, no matter who you are. Dylan understood that. So he was into music of that nature, and there's a great cover of that song, But In My Eyes, on World Gone Wrong. It's a little bit darker than his predecessor, maybe. And so it's a treat to have this live performance of it. I remember when I first heard this, I was in college, and it was like the late 90s, and I just was like, wow. I mean, what that so easily could not have happened. And the band, it's a very fittingly warm recording, wouldn't you say? The idea of a supper club.
Oh, yeah.
And you're there. And the sound, the actual recorded quality of the sound, has a warmth to it that reflects the being there, if you will.
It's interesting, too, when you mentioned the different voices of Dylan, because I've seen him four times, and I think it was once in the 80s, once in the 90s, again in the late 90s, and then midway through the 2000s. And, yeah, it's been a different voice each time, but never any less effective.
It does. It changes a lot, and it one of the reasons his voice changes a lot is because he didn't take great care of it, the smoking, and then the way he sang. But there are just great singers, like Liam Gallagher, for a few years, like 93 through 96, had one of the greatest instruments in rock and roll history with his voice, but he didn't sing the right way, and he essentially blew out his voice. And John Lennon's voice changed dramatically from like 64 into 65. He didn't like wreck it, but the smoking and the marijuana made it more adenoidal, I would say. So Dylan always understood, though, how to coax meaning out of words by the portions of them that you're going to emphasize. So even when the voice isn't necessarily there, in terms of like it's like structurally it's breaking down somewhat, he's still able to emote and evince because he understands phrasing, he understands silence. And it's like Billie Holiday at the end of her truncated life and career, where she still knows how to get across what she wants to get across, but it's not coming in the same sort of like polished, clean, gleaming vessel that it would have 10 years earlier, 15 years earlier. So this is Dylan in a nice, comfortable spot. I could see someone listening to it, though, and being like, oh, I don't like that. I don't like that voice. It sounds wizened or whatever term one wants to apply. But this would be in like the Dylan shortlist with the 66 World Tour recordings, with like the Berkeley 65 from December electric set. It's just one of those great all-timer Dylan pieces. And if you'd release this, you could make a guy like me could write a piece saying, this is one of the best live albums ever, now that we officially have it. Some of us knew that before. It's that good.
From Bob Dylan to a different type of music to my ears, what a blast it was to go back and listen to October 12th, 1979, the great Johnny Most broadcasting the debut of Larry Bird as a Boston Celtic.
Johnny Most is such an interesting person because when I was growing up, I would try to wow my parents with my Johnny Most impression. I didn't know what I was doing. I was like five, but I just like to burn a DJ, bang! it's I don't know, it's kind of like war in a way, but like with jump shots. So I was into that. And he's spoken of as this like massive, massive homer. And he deserves it in such a richer way than someone like Tommy Heinsohn, who was branded a homer. But if you listen to, like, you can go on YouTube and listen to, like, Tommy Heinsohn games, even from the 80s, where he's doing the national broadcast, like, at the final, and he's doing a Celtics game. He's right down the middle. I don't think people know that. Like, when he was on national TV doing even Celtics games, he was not this homer. And even when he was doing, like, the Celtics games for the network, he would gripe both ways. Johnny Most wouldn't really do that. He was an interesting person. He was a war hero. He was a poet. I mean, he was a thinking man. He was a Renaissance man. I that's what I was sort of like taken by going through all these old clips of his lately. But he was a homer in such a hilarious way to me. Like, I remember when I was a kid with Magic Johnson. I didn't really understand this at the time, but I didn't understand the origin of this. But you remember how we would call Magic Johnson Crybaby?
Oh, yes.
And it was because when, like, Johnson was complaining about a call or something, But what I didn't get about was that Johnny Most was so casual about it. He just worked it into his patois. He'd be like, baby, with the no-look pass. He would just short it to baby. I'm just like, why is he calling this guy this? It was, do you remember the 1980s Giants shortstop, Johnny LeMaster?
Yeah, I sure do. Like, yes.
He was like pretty good glove, but like awful, awful hitter. One of the worst hitters of my lifetime. And I'd be listening to like Vince Scully in the Game of the Week. And LeMaster would come up, and Scully would be saying, it's like, here's LeMaster. I thought he was saying the master every time. This guy's hitting like a buck 18. What's going on here?
The
master. I'm like, wow, this guy's so great. He transcends the need to have like vaguely competent offensive performances. And it was only like years later when I got like his Topps card. I'm like, oh. So when I heard Johnny Most doing that as a kid, I didn't really get it. But again, joking about the Starbucks. But just the pungency of the personality, Kimball, is something that whether you are rooting for the team he was so blatantly rooting for or not, it does a body and soul good to hear someone into something for the right reason.
I must share with you my Johnny Most story. This was, I want to say, late 70s probably, maybe early 80s. Went with some buddies to see a Celtics game. Didn't have tickets. Thought we could get them from scalpers, but for whatever reason, they were clamping down on the scalpers that day, and it looked like we were going to get shut out. And then we saw Johnny Most making his way down the street by fours. And we said, well, here's our chance. And we went up and said, Johnny, hey, how are you? We came down here from Maine hoping to get into the game. We can't find any tickets. Any chance you can help us out? And he was with the woman he was dating at the time, a stripper by the name of Busty Hart. And Johnny said, fellas, I wish I could help you. I got no tickets, and as you can see, my hands are full.
I'm sure it wasn't the premiere of that joke from Mr. Moe.
No, I don't think so.
Probably been trotted out a few times. Yeah, the four's closed, I think it was last year.
Yeah, it did, yeah.
It was one of those Boston bars that was just, like, knocked down by, I mean, so many of them, but, like, that was, and a lot of them were kind of, like, scuzzy. But that one was, like, one of the classier ones. So, like, when I saw that one knocked down, too, I thought, oh, geez, wow, you can tell, like, the impact that this is having on everything. But I don't know. And, of course, he died fairly early because of the smoking. But to hear this YouTube broadcast of the complete first game, the Celtics with Larry Bird, and I saw some post today on Twitter saying, like, Larry Bird was such a true power forward. It's like, well, you didn't really understand what Larry Bird was doing because he was by no means a power forward. He was, which isn't to imply like any kind of weakness or anything, but power forwards don't pass the basketball like that. And so it's interesting to hear Most warming to this person who's obviously, I think it was evident early on, like straight away, was going to be this big time Boston sports presence. And I think for all of the talk about Larry Bird, I think he's been underrated somewhat over the years. You think about something like in the NBA, how hard it is to win the MVP. If you win the MVP, you're going to the Hall of Fame. I mean, maybe not like Derrick Rose or not Derrick Rose, but for the most part, you win an MVP in the NBA, you're going to the Hall of Fame. The same can't be said of baseball. Bird wins three in a row. That's just like one of those feats that stands out to me. But you could tell, and you could tell that Most could tell and was keen to be in on this for the next decade,
right,
that here was someone who was going to be one of like a Bill Russell sort of like transcendent Boston sports figure.
Colin Fleming with us here on Damptown. Let's talk about a couple of great radio dramas. First, always one of the best, wonderful episode of Quiet Please, Pathetic Fallacy. And you mentioned this in your note to me, but boy, the audio quality is so good on this.
Yeah, that is with dogs. Usually, Quiet Please is that most of the episodes don't survive in, well, I don't even want to say pristine sound, but like in sound that you don't have to kind of work to get through. So this survives in good sound, and then someone did a remastering job on it. And Quiet Please, you really can't go wrong with any of the episodes. Part of the reason is the quality. They're always like in the same qualitative ballpark. And also, the show wasn't on that long. So it's not like it could get ropey because it was on for 9 years or whatnot, because it just had this short run. And so I think what I said to you is this is the gold standard of radio horror. Now, that doesn't mean, like, if you made a list of the best horror episodes in the history of radio, that you wouldn't cover an assortment of series, because you would. But if we were just covering the series themselves, this one separates itself by a decent margin from number two. This is frontline, high-level radio art. This is actual art. So this is not really a scary episode. It's a prescient one, and it's about this scientist who has this giant computer. You get the sense that it takes up multiple rooms, and it can do whatever you ask it to do mathematically, and whatever the fraction is. It's like 1/1,000,000,000th of a second or something. So a man and a woman reporters come, and they're on their beat, and they're just sort of going to do this. It's like a puff piece type of thing. And the way that this works is the computer is called Machine. So it becomes like a character name. Like, it sort of gets into your brain that way, too. And that's done intentionally. So the scientist is like this nebbish kind of guy. Is like, Machine, 2 + 2. Like, yeah, it's going to be awesome. Watch how fast it is. And then one of the reporters is like, buddy, turn around the screen. He got it wrong. And the machine, female machine, sort of, does get it wrong. And what ends up happening is this guy gets so embarrassed. The scientist's career comes apart. Or he thinks it's going to, and the story, like, one of the reporters slams him, and he's a laughing stock. But what's happening is the machine has fallen in love with the nebbish scientist. And the female reporter is going to play matchmaker, which is really cool. But I think what's borderline brilliant about this episode is that the machine talks in, like, numbers. But the numbers function such that we can understand them as words. I mean, which is really clever when you think about it.
And we've talked about it before, but it's amazing to me that more people don't know about Ernest Chappell, because he's so great in all of these episodes.
Ernest Chappell was not someone you would have expected, based upon what he had been, to come out and be this towering radio talent. He is, as we're told at the end of these episodes, the man who spoke to us, which is the sign-off. And he had an affiliation with Orson Welles and the Campbell Playhouse and being like the announcer, which was a good gig if you could get it at the time. You would sort of just be like the MC who talked us into what was going to be Welles's introduction. You talked us out at the end, told us what was coming on later that night, sort of thing. And those guys did well for themselves. They were always guys, as far as I know. And Willis Cooper, though, had a vision, and that's something that just people don't have. I'd say they have less of that than ever, where Willis Cooper heard something in Ernest Chappell and thought, you can be this thing if I put you in the right environment, or you're allowed to have that platform. You will expand that platform. So the episode it's touching. It really is.
Yeah.
Quietly, wittily, beautiful, and the machine is talking in all of these numbers. And this is what I love about it. And to these abstruse calculations, I don't even know if they're right or wrong. I mean, I guess I could, like, sit down and, like, work them out. But it's like high-level math. But we know, even when she's talking in numbers, we know exactly what she's saying because of the cadence of her voice.
Right.
It's sort of like that robotic but still emotion of the voice. And it's almost like when you read A Clockwork Orange by Anthony Burgess, something by James Joyce. Well, not something, but like Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake. If you read it aloud, the meaning comes clear to you in the wake, even though it might not look like English sometimes. That's really what's happening here.
And also a wonderful episode, a fun episode of X-1, The Last Martian, with strange things going on down at Barney's Tavern.
I see this as kind of a missed opportunity, because I like the conceit quite a lot. And we have a newspaper reporter again, and he has to go down to a bar because there's this guy getting soused. There's like, I was on Mars earlier today. and then, like, everyone's dead. Now I'm here. I'm, like, on the bus. I'm going to work. I'm this other guy getting drunk. I'm just, like, not in a good headspace right now. And he really seems to believe what he's saying. And there's just a lot you can fructify with that. You can do so much with it, and I feel this is an episode of X Minus One, which is the best sci-fi show. It doesn't make the most of the opportunity because it goes in too many scattered directions at the end, and it does become ropey. But the guy goes down there in the expense report, like shades of Johnny Dollar, so we can have all the booze, and it's just like, this will be a cushy gig. We'll do this puff piece. And the guy is the Martian, a sensible Martian, is saying, well, I went through all this, and his story is like kind of believable, and also the conviction with which he says it. But now he has to go home and like deal with his wife because he's inhabiting this body. He wants to make the best of things. So it's like kind of like, in a way, like this weird threesome thing too that's going on here too. And so the reporter's like, ah, come along for moral support. It turns out that some guy who works at the paper is later going to go there and murder this guy. It's like that comes out of nowhere. Like, yeah. You're not given any sort of narrative reason to expect that to make any sense. And then as it turns out, I'll just spoil it, like everybody is a Martian and everyone died on Mars and got embedded in these bodies. And so the guy shows up to murder him and he decides not to because, oh, our man, the original Martian, who's not the last Martian, he had been in an asylum. So no one takes it as like, ah, you messed up. It's fine. You can't do us any harm. You won't give it away. You're too crazy. And then the guy's wife, all along, I guess, this just makes no sense. She's like, I'm a Martian too. It's like, well, so am I. Sea Dog the Martian. Like, hanging out with the great Kazoo.
All right. Finally, last week, we extolled the virtues of the forgotten Icebox Chamberlain. This week, another great player from the 19th century. I love some of the stat lines on Chicken Wolf, who played for Louisville and put up a stat I don't know anybody's ever matched. 2 home runs and 102 RBIs in the same year.
Oh, there's quite a bit of that. There's quite a bit of that up through, really, Ruth. I mean, there's an awful lot of that. Like, think of Ty Cobb. Ty Cobb only hit this many home runs. Go on Baseball Reference later and look in the league leaders for Ty Cobb's career because he's hitting like 3 home runs every year. He's in the top 10 like 9 times, like more than all of these other sluggers. It just was how it was. I think you were hitting, you know, like when you have the socks out of the laundry and like you fold them together into like that little sock ball. I think that's what the baseball was. So it wasn't going to go that far. And Chicken Wolf's stat line it's actually kind of reminiscent of, it was like a 19th century John Olerud. He has this one year where he hits like 363.
Right.
I think it's what Olerud hit one year.
Yes, he did.
And then he's a 290 career hitter. He played for his hometown Louisville squad in the American Association for like 9 of the 10 years of his career. He was a really good ball player who died quite young. I think he was in his early 40s. And all we know about his death is it was somehow related to a fireman in an accident. I almost feel like he was a volunteer fireman, perhaps, but you get all these stories. Like one day he hit this memorable walk-off home run. It was an inside-the-park home run because that's what your home runs would have been.
Right.
And he only got the home run because there was like this angry, rabid, sleeping dog who was near the ball, and the outfielder is like, oh, no, I don't want to feel that. And I guess we have to address his name. And I wanted to see like some amazing story when I learned about this guy a few years ago. Turns out he had this buddy, another pretty good ball player named Pete Browning. And before a game one day, Chicken Wolf, who, did you see what his real name is?
No, I didn't.
He is William Van Winkle Wolf.
Man, that's better than Chicken.
It would be better than Chicken Wolf.
Yeah.
It's like a cross between Headless Horseman and Hessians and like Prokofiev.
Wow.
Like Peter the Wolf.
I love that.
He was like, I'm famished, Pete Browning. And Browning's like, well, you know, you shouldn't eat too much. We have a big game today. And the person who's about to become Chicken Wolf is like, no, I am tearing into this chicken. And he just eats himself into a stupor. And you're in Maine. They're like farms. People have poultry, I guess. It's like, we got a wolf eating the chickens. Chicken Wolf forevermore. And actually, like, not a Hall of Fame ball player, but we talk about the Hall of Fame of very good. He is solidly ensconced in that. He had quite a career.
And has, I would say, a Hall of Fame mustache from the picture I saw on Baseball Reference.
There is this series of baseball cards called Old Judge.
And oh, so yes, yes.
Not only do I have an interest in these things, I figure at some point down the line, I'll write a book based upon the Old Judge card series and go into the lives of these people, because they're almost like ready-made short story too. So I'll just treat it as nonfiction and base it off of, like, here's their card. And Old Judge was really cool because, like, you went to some house and it was staged in like a living room with the ball, and like the ball's hanging on a string. So it's like this avant-garde modernism, and he has like this great Old Judge cards. They're in MoMA. I mean, they are that beautiful. They're legitimate works of art. So he looked like you'd expect him to look. I don't know that he ever left the state that he was from. I mean, he just seemed like, I'm from here, I play for this team, died young, and no umpiring career for him, but it's just replete. That era is just replete with character. So it's like in keeping with like a Johnny Most, as far removed as they might seem from each other. And I don't know. I think when we don't have individuality like that, that like the group suffers, if you will.
Suffice it to say, there are no chicken wolves out there today in Major League Baseball.
Chicken wolf, yeah. Van Winkle.
It's Colin Fleming on Downtown. Colin, thanks as always. We'll do it again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.
It is 5:31. When we return, Dennis Price tells us what's up for entertainment in Central Maine next on Downtown.
This is Graham. You're listening to my dad on Downtown of the Rich Kimball.
Everything is awesome.